This is Web Crawler with Andrew Hawthorne. The views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. Web Crawler with Andrew Hawthorne on the VOCM Radio Network.
We've talked before on the show about the differences in making media like books or video games for kids as opposed to adults. All that gets compounded when you're trying to make something educational and add something of substance that makes your readers or players into students as well. Today we're talking to Clockwork Fox's president Ed Martin and their lead game designer and director of education Conrad Nichols. Hey guys, how you doing?
Great, thanks. How you doing?
I'm doing swell, I am.
Super.
Just tell us a bit about Clockwork Fox. What kind of things you do there?
So we are an education technology startup with a focus on game-based learning. In particular, we're focused on helping teachers and students improve outcomes in math for kindergarten through grade 3. Our main product is called Zorbit's Math Adventure. What we do is that we make games that are really fun and engaging for kids, but that are also really good at teaching math. So we combine those two things really well to make a product that has a significant impact for kids' learning, but also for kids' attitudes towards math, because kids can develop a sort of a fear of math at a very early level, so we're trying to make it really accessible for them at those early stages.
As an educational, you know, software, how did you refer to it? You had a really great phrase a second ago.
Is it game-based learning?
Perhaps, yeah. Like, does that go beyond games in terms of what kind of technologies and software you're developing, or is it focused on kind of communicating these ideas through games?
So there's a couple of different elements. There's the games themselves, which the kids are interfacing with, and the kids are, interacting with math and those and getting valuable feedback. Depending on how they're performing, and the games adapt to the student's ability, so they're getting a personalized experience. So they're engaging with math at their level. Beyond that, we're doing a few other things as well. So all the data, all the information that a student is recording as they're playing, we are keeping in a database, and we use all of this data and analytics to provide teachers with reports on how students are doing, and it's all aligned to the different curricula across Canada and the U.S. So teachers are going to see their specific curriculum reflected in the game and the reports, and then they can use all the data and the assessments to find out where the learning gaps might be in the classroom and specifically target those to target the areas where students might be showing the greatest weakness. We've got some other, you want to talk a bit about some of like the in-class activities and the tools we have?
Yeah, definitely. We have a library of in-class activities on the teacher dashboard that teachers can access at any time. These are a suite of activities that teachers can download that all these different kinds of manipulatives that students will use in the classroom that they focus on different math concepts and different learning gaps. And so as students are playing through the game and the game is collecting data, they'll be able to find out exactly where the learning gaps are that their class is experiencing, and they can find these in-class activities that specifically relate to where their class is struggling and get some extra hands-on practice with those.
Wow, so there's all these, you know, back-end teacher resources in context with the software, hey?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Tell us a bit about Zorbit Math Adventure specifically. What kind of a game is this?
The overarching idea of Zorbit's Math Adventure is you've got your three main characters, Zorbit, Zoe, and Serena, and they're in school. They're in a space academy, and they are traveling around the galaxy, traveling to different planets to help them solve problems on their planets, which will allow them to graduate further and further in their studies at the space academy. Every step of the way, whatever kind of challenges or narratives they're encountering, they're using math to solve problems. So, Conrad, why don't you just pick one example and sort of talk through?
Yeah, definitely. So each of the planets they visit is themed after one of the major math concepts that students are working on in that grade. So they may visit a planet that's entirely based around operations. One of our planets, the spaceport, for example, is an operations planet where the director of the spaceport has gone missing, and so all the cargo and containers has gone haywire. And so students have to use their operation skills, like addition and subtraction and place value, to try and help sort things out and to find the director again. So they're using all these math elements to try and solve their way through a narrative.
So give us an example of the kind of problem a student would encounter while they're learning at Space Academy in this game.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the great examples we have is a game that uses a balance. So students have to they have to measure the mass of an object, and they have to do that by finding out what combination of other weights is going to add up to get the same mass as that other object. So this is a bit of a problem-solving activity for students, as they have to try and figure out what combination of things is going to fit together to make it work. But meanwhile, they're also getting this great visual feedback at the same time, as they can see the balance is moving in real time as they're adding and subtracting weights to it.
Where did the whole concept come from? How did you come up with this as the basis for a math educational game?
So we were more of a general game development company initially, and we were doing a whole bunch of different projects. We were doing some stuff in augmented reality and some more casual games. And then we sort of identified that we were talking to some teacher friends of ours that there was a problem with the math game world. Whereas games were either in one of two categories. Games that were good at teaching math were really not engaging for kids, and the games that were engaging for kids were really not good at teaching math. Nothing was doing both of these things well at the same time. And we saw a really big gap there. So we just started with doing one game at the time. And actually, the first time we did it, we made the game, we got it tested, and kids really enjoyed the game, but it didn't work. They didn't actually get better at math. So we said, okay, we need to start working with some more smart math people. And so we tried again. And the second time we did it, we created a game for preschool. And we got that one tested, and we did a study with Kent State University in Ohio, and that study showed that kids who play the game for as little as 1 hour a week over a three-week period showed a six-month advancement in their math skills. And so that's when we knew we were really onto something. And we also the study also showed they had improved attitudes towards math. So we were doing the two things we wanted to do, make kids enjoy math more, but also see them learn more quickly and effectively. And that's when the company started to take a shift. So instead of just being a general game developers, we said, you know, we have a tremendous opportunity with Zorbit. There's a huge need for this. We're going to focus all our efforts on Zorbit's math adventure. And at that point, we shifted from being a game development company to an education technology company that makes educational games.
So I guess the general question is, maybe this is too big a question, is how'd you do that? You know, there's been math video games as long as there's been video games. When I was a kid, you know, we had Sesame Street video games on old green screen computers, and we had Super Solvers when I was in elementary school, or Reader Rabbit, all that kind of stuff. How has our approach to educating with video games changed, or has it? Is it just better?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot, actually. There's a great trend in the 90s and the early 2000s of what they call chocolate-covered broccoli in terms of educational video games. And so this is where game designers would try and wrap up educational content in lots of bells and whistles and lots of fun particles, and they would try and make the education seemed like it was really fun, but in reality, it was just a digital worksheet that the students were working on. It was nothing different than what they would see on paper. What we're trying to do at Clockwork Fox is something a little bit different. We're not going for that digital worksheet approach. We're going for a much more robust problem-solving approach, where all of the math is wholly integrated into the game itself. So in previous games where the math would be really separated from the kinds of mechanics that the students would be playing in the games, we're trying to combine these two things together to make something really novel.
I'll give a specific example. There's a really popular math game called Math Blast or Hyper Blast. It's very well known in the education community. And there was the concept of this game, it was like you're a spaceship traveling through space and you're shooting asteroids and things like that. And that in itself is a pretty fun, you know, basic game, something akin to, what was that Atari game?
Oh, right. Space Invaders.
Yeah, something similar to Space Invaders. But eventually, you're playing this game that's really fun, and every so often, boom, a math problem jumps up. And it says, you know, what is 2 times 3? And you have to answer that problem. The fact that the math problem pops up has nothing to do with the gameplay itself. And in fact, what it is, it's an obstacle. If you get that wrong, you're gonna lose some hit points. It's going to stop your progress in the game, which can actually develop a negative association with the math, because the math becomes your enemy. The math becomes the obstacle you need to overcome. In Zorbit's Math Adventure, the math is your ally. The math is the tool that you are using to overcome obstacles in the game. And that's a huge psychological shift for kids. when in terms of math not being the thing they need to fight against, but the thing that they are using to fight against other things.
That's fascinating. You know, what you're describing sounds like Apollo 13 or something like that, where, you know, the problem was getting these guys back from outer space where they're stuck. And the solution to that is just using their brains, solving math problems one thing or at another. You see, you have the guys on the ground, and that's how you win. It's not an obstacle to overcome.
That's exactly it, yeah.
Wow. How is designing a game for a kid, and what is the age level for Zorbit's Math Adventure?
Kindergarten through grade 2 right now, and grade 3 is coming on board soon.
Yeah, how is that different from designing a general game for, you know, a mature or even a general audience?
It's very different. Yeah, there's some fascinating constraints to have to work with in terms of design for a game. So we start with a really math-first approach where we take a look at the curriculums and the learning outcomes that students need to work with. And we start with those and go from the ground up. So I'll take a look at the different kinds of math problems that students will need to learn and the different ways that they'll approach those and the different kinds of manipulatives and models that they're using in their classroom. And once we've got those basic ideas dialed down, then we can actually start developing the game around those mathematical models. But the funny thing with game design, again, in educational system, is that even if you come up with a really fun idea, if it doesn't fit the math and if it doesn't serve the math well, you have to throw that idea out and kind of go with a different route. And so you're working with these really interesting constraints where you need to really focus on these specific learning outcomes, as well as making that fun, as well as making a game for a really young audience. And so having a really intuitive interface is something that's super important for us.
Yeah, and I come from a background in children's television, and there's all kinds of different rules around, you know, even just the types of narratives you want to have and things like that. But we do a lot of playtesting. You know, we just sort of put it in kids' hands and watch them go, and it's the greatest education in the world for us. Not only is it really rewarding and fun, but we learn so much. I mean, sometimes you'll watch a kid play, and there's something in the game that you think is going to be really challenging, and then they have no problem figuring it out whatsoever. And then other times there are things where we think something might be really intuitive, and it really stumps kids as well. So you know, as designers, we try as much as possible to put ourselves, you know, in the shoes of a kid who might be, you know, four to 8 years old. But you can't know everything. You've got to get it in their hands and watch them do it. One of the greatest challenges we have is login systems. You know, kids, especially in kindergarten, you need a username and password to play the game so that we have a profile that all of the data is going to. But, you know, it's actually really complicated, you know, because kids are still just learning their numbers and letters at that point.
That's fascinating. So how do you get around that? How does a kindergartner log in to a game?
Well, we've got a system now where we have a really basic username and password. We let the teachers also change them that they want, so they can make it something basic they want. We also have, on the teachers' side of things, they can print out all these login cards, so they can just take the card and sort of stick it on a student's desk or in their binder so they can always reference it. But I also think we're shifting over the course of the summer now to a more of a picture-based login system as well. So instead of kids having to memorize a sequence of letters or even just a word, they can go and just remember a couple of pictures, which we think is going to make it even easier for them to log in.
Mm-hmm.
This is Web Trawler with Andrew Hawthorne on the VOCM Radio Network.
You mentioned working with the curriculum and kind of building the game around those kinds of things when you're thinking about educational software. What kinds of things do you have to take into account from just an educational perspective designing this stuff?
Oh, man. So we have to cover some pretty niche learning standards sometimes, which is a really interesting thing to get around. So not only do students need to learn about basics like addition and subtraction, but they need to learn about addition and subtraction in really particular ways. So maybe they need to learn about a really specific way to solve a math problem, and that's actually a really important learning outcome for them to cover. So we need to make an activity in our game that somehow accomplishes and directly approaches this one learning outcome that they need to cover. So one example is... students might have to work with the numbers, say, 31 and 29, and they need to split the number 31 into two numbers, 30 and 1. And then the number 29, split that apart into 20 and 9, and then recombine those. And so we need to make an activity that somehow
that somehow covers this really specific weird learning outcome?
What we do is we look at all of the curricula across North America, and we create sort of a master curriculum that covers everything. From province to province, state to state, then as depending on what your particular standards are, that's in the system, so then the system can sort of pull on that master curriculum all the particular elements that are relevant to that one region.
Yeah, so how specific do you have to get? Like, are there weird quirks that you need to incorporate in, or can you tailor this to one province's or one state's idea of how math should be taught?
Yeah, we're doing both of those things, actually. We're working with all of those weird quirks across Canada, as well as tailoring it to every single province. So it'll be things like in Ontario, they multiply all the way up to 7, but in British Columbia, they only multiply up to 5. And so those slight little changes in the data ranges that students are working with are all reflected in the game as well.
There's a lot of interesting, math is a big topic these days.
Yeah.
We understand that there's kind of two camps. There's a camp of people who think that everything should be discovery-based, and there's a camp of people who think, like, repetition and practice, is needed to be the focus. And, I think there's a huge debate as to which approach is, but we feel like, the answer is a bit of both, and that's what we really try to incorporate into the game.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's lots of comments about, this new math and things like that, but I think it's really all about, for us, the way we approach things is making it accessible for kids. I mean, that is our main thing, and making sure that kids can get in there and understand what's going on and enjoy the process.
I wanted to ask about something that you mentioned on your blog. What is blended learning?
Yeah, blended learning is when teachers use a mix of technology and traditional lectures in their classroom. So they're both teaching in the traditional method, where they'll give students maybe a paper worksheet or some manipulatives to work with, but then at the same time they're going to be blending in some of the more new advanced technological features that they can have in the classroom, such as using smart boards or using iPads, or even sending kids home to watch YouTube videos for reference for homework.
That could be dangerous. I just did a story about a kid who taught himself to drive using YouTube videos.
Sure. I have a 2-year-old who I'm probably going to figure that out himself soon as well. We really try to, like, we obviously believe in the power of games, but we also think it cannot even be close to be the only thing that you're doing. And that's why we really, we've got the games, but we also have this big database of offline activities mm-hmm. that we want people to engage in as well, and you can use them really effectively together. So you can start kids off the day, they're playing Zorbit. You can go in and look at their data and say, oh, you know what, the kids seem to be struggling in this particular area. I am going to do an offline activity with these kids this afternoon in this particular area so I can try to help them understand this particular concept better.
How common is this blend of technology and traditional learning in the classroom right now? Are a lot of teachers using technology this way?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely becoming a fast-rising thing. I think teachers are really recognizing the great impact that can have on their classroom. Technology really gives students the opportunity to learn at their own pace as well. With Zorbit's Math Adventure, for example, they can get the chance to go as fast or as slow as they want through the levels, and they can repeat and replay some of the activities if they need to. Whereas in a traditional classroom, if you miss something, sometimes that's it. That was your chance to learn it. So with this nice blend, you get both approaches.
Yeah, because one of the biggest challenges that teachers face is that they've got really diverse people in the classroom. How do you address all those specific needs? You might have a student who's really, really excellent at geometry, but struggles with operations, and then another kid who's completely the opposite. So how do you teach to everyone so that everyone is learning? And it tends to be, teachers generally have to teach towards the middle, so the kids who are struggling a bit more can get left behind. The kids who are maybe a little more advanced maybe aren't as engaged as you would like. So that's where something like Zorbit comes in, and the kids can dive in and play content that is completely at their level, that will keep them engaged, and to use one of Conrad's favorite terms, in their zone of proximal development. It's kind of a nerdy education term, but it means that kids are engaging in content that is not too hard or too easy. It's in a space that's going to maximize their enjoyment and their learning.
Where's all this going? Do you think that video games are just going to be used in the classroom in the future?
I mean, gosh, I hope they're going to be used in the classroom in the future. There's all the evidence points towards them being a really effective way to help boost outcomes for students. In no way should technology replace teachers. I think teachers serve an immeasurable role in the classroom. But I think the two can really help each other out and really boost the effectiveness of each other.
Yeah, there's lots of really interesting studies coming out now showing that, you know, games, not any game, but games done the right way, can have significant positive impact. But it's always going to be, you know, one part of a whole. You know, and I think an important element, but as Conrad said, it's a tool that helps teachers do their job, hopefully more effectively, but it's ultimately the teacher who's going to win the day.
Well, that's the question. If they're not going to replace teachers, do you think that they would replace textbooks? Like, is this going to be the base tool that teachers are going to be using to educate?
Yeah, well, I mean, imagine an electronic version of a textbook, you know, that could ask harder or easier questions depending on the student's ability. Like, that's an awesome way to give something that's very similar to a textbook, but that's going to adapt to the student's understanding and knowledge. But then imagine an even more engaging version of that that's asking them, like, more real questions, or that's asking them more problem-solving or game-based learning style questions. And that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
So from purely a Jetsons point of view, what is this going to look like in 10 or 15 years? Are we talking about, you know, VR headsets in classrooms, or do you think that it might be trending towards more of a post-classroom world where you have learning time on your phone, in your own time, and kind of communicate with a teacher over the internet?
Oh, prognostications. I would say the way things are going, I think, yeah, technology is going to become more pervasive. There's no doubt about it. It's a sort of a question of what form that's in. Like, we think augmented reality is a really cool technology that can be used effectively. But, you know, whenever new technologies come out, you always just tend to get wowed by the technology itself. But it's a matter of finding the right implementations and finding ones that are not just cool to look at, but ones that actually advance learning. But I do think that, you know, AR and VR can certainly have a big impact, especially when you look at, you know, it's going to be different in different subject matter, but I've already seen, you know, VR experiences that, you know, maybe teach history or geography or geology in an incredible way, you know? So I think absolutely more technology technology is not going away in classrooms, that's for sure. And in terms of where, you know, things are ultimately going, I think adaptive learning is a really important technology. So I've talked a lot about personalization here today and making sure kids are engaging with content that's at their level. But adaptive learning technology is kind of this big data idea where it's analyzing students across different curricula and where their aptitudes are, and not just what they're performing well or poorly in, but the reasons behind that. And then actively trying to give students the optimal content in the optimal format all the time. And I think it's a really exciting technology, something that we've been diving into and really looking to expand. And I think that is going to be one of the key technologies in education moving forward.
What other stuff is Clockwork Fox working on right now?
I mean, Zorbit is a big thing, so grade 3 we're working on right now. We've also got some other, we're going to start working on grade 4 through 6 soon as well, but we've got a completely different cool concept for that. I think it'll still be in the Zorbit world, but it's going to be a different type of gameplay because it's a, you know, an older, more mature audience that I think is going to work really well. We're also doing some more little smaller side activities that we think are more, we're trying to do some more co-op type things, so things that kids can work on together, but still using technology and still staying within the Zorbit and the whole Zorbit philosophy of using problem solving to learn math. So everything still in, you know, the education space and within this, with math space is really where we've developed our expertise, but we've got lots of different things that we're moving forward. And our adaptive learning system is also a thing that we're really focusing on and just trying to make more intelligent and more effective all the time.
And how can people find out more about you if they'd like to learn about it or get a copy of Zorbit to try out?
For sure. orbitsmath.com, and anyone can sign up for a free trial right there and learn a little more about it. And for teachers or for parents or anyone who might like to try it out, you can sign up for a free trial there, get your account, and then play either in a web browser or by downloading our iPad or iPhone apps.
Ed Martin and Conrad Nichols, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Andrew.
Cheers, folks.
This has been Web Trawler with Andrew Hawthorne on the VOCM Radio Network.